Good morning. I'm Hank Greeley from Stanford University, and I'm here at the first annual meeting of the Neuroethics Society with my friend and colleague, Dr. Judy Illes. It's great to see you again, Judy.
Well, it's great to be with you, Hank.
Several years ago, you and I were sitting around and kicking around the idea of a Neuroethics Society. I wonder what your recollections are of our early talks.
Oh, you know, it's a great question, especially that we're here together celebrating this first annual meeting with a capacity crowd. We have people standing in the back of the room, people represented from so many different disciplines. I'm just thrilled. I have to tell you, you know, I think you'll remember that at first I wasn't as excited as you were about the prospects of an independent organization devoted to neuroethics.
I don't think I had to drag you kicking and screaming, but I do remember that you weren't as enthusiastic as
That's
I
right.
was.
That's right. I didn't kick and scream, but I had some reservations. I worried about becoming disenfranchised from bioethics and from neuroscience at once. I worried about fragmentation. I worried about limited people capacity and isolation. So I think those were legitimate concerns at the time, but the response to neuroethics was just wow. I think judging from our growing membership, numbers of publications, journals on neuroethics, expanding country involvement, and now this annual meeting, fantastic. So, you know, it was a vision that you promulgated, we shared it with others, and I'm so glad you pushed it forward, and I think that we've worked very hard, but we've done really well.
Well, even though you were initially less enthusiastic than I was, I think you were more important probably in actually moving it forward and making sure that it happened.
Well, I think we all bring strengths to the table.
What are you doing these days?
I'm having a ball in beautiful British Columbia. We've really been forging ahead with our new center. We've been open now for a year, and I think we have three major areas. The first one is the one I brought forward from Stanford, where I directed the neuroethics program before you, and that first focus is really on needs assessments and resources for neuroscientists. In the COP lecture I gave in 2006 for the Society for Neuroscience, I vowed to work really hard to understand the incentives and barriers to incorporating ethics right up front in neuroscience and to develop resources for neuroscientists based on what I find. And I think we're making great progress on that front with my research fellow, Carrion, and Daniel Buckman, who's here with us at the meeting. We're starting to really understand from the ground what we need to provide to neuroscientists so that they can really readily embrace and take up ethics in a user-friendly way, in a way that's really empowering. So we're very excited about that. We're focusing on neuroimaging and neurostimulation first, along with imaging genetics in the mix, because I really think that's the future of where we're going. And we have some parallel studies going on with investigators who do neurodegenerative disease work using drugs and devices and regenerative medicine approaches. So we have a lot of work to do in that domain, but there is definitely a light at the end of the tunnel. And I'd say in the next 3 years, we'll have a wide array, at least the first release of a wide array of tools that are resource and case-based and that can be accessed both through traditional and modern media, and hopefully with a lot of people very happily taking it up. Second focus of three is really consistent with my international dreams for the society, and it's on an area that Sofia Lombera and I have called global health neuroethics. And we've launched this arm of neuroethics at UBC by examining how contextual differences can be taken into account when scientific and technological innovations are transferred to new communities. So how does the socioeconomic and cultural and religious context of a community affect the movement of neuroscience innovation into that community? And we've been investigating the impact on brain science and the global environment along the four basic themes that we really put in place at the Mapping the Field meeting in 2002 that Dana supported and the AAAS was part of and was hosted by Stanford and UCSF. And so that was brain and the self, brain and social policy, brain and clinical practice, and brain and discourse. And you know, we've documented an early and steady increase in global participation in neuroethics, also among the developing world. And, you know, we're seeing the indicators of technology creation and technology diffusion in developing countries are specifically correlated with increases in literature on policy implications of brain science. And so we're starting to work on some key empirical questions. So, for example, what culturally relevant criteria are needed to define brain health and brain disease, given different healthcare systems and societal values? In fact, we're embarking now on a project in the northern regions of British Columbia, where the population has been heavily hit by what seems to be a dominant form of Alzheimer's disease. And we're starting to tap into that community, work with that community to understand these sorts of questions about brain health and brain disease.
Early onset?
Early onset. Very, very striking. So along these lines, we're trying to understand how the cross-fertilization of approaches to caring for young people and the elderly can be improved. What are just policies, again, in the context of different systems and different societal values? We're trying to understand how tensions between faith healers and contemporary practitioners can be managed and better intersected so that communities can be treated not only medically but spiritually, and really meeting both those needs. So it's really it's the impact of neuroscience on communities, genetics, molecular biology, neuroimaging as it's appropriate, neurostimulation as it's appropriate, and culture.
The international and intercultural work substantively sounds really fascinating, and you've certainly been one of the main voices inside the society for having the society reach out to be more international in scope. I think we've had this difficulty in expanding beyond North America. Difficulty's too strong. I think most of our membership is based in the United States and Canada. Expanding beyond that has been somewhat challenging. How do you see us growing the society throughout the rest of the world?
You know, I think that's probably one of the most exciting directions that our society is going to take. But, you know, we should note that we have 411 members of the society here at the meeting. We're at almost 180 participants represented by 26 different countries. So I think we're well on our way. And some of our international members actually came, I was speaking with them earlier today during the break. They're here from Italy, three Italian members who came specifically to D.C. for this meeting. So I think the buzz is catching on. And also what I'd like to see very much is the formal establishment of branches or chapters of the Neuroethics Society in Europe, in Asia, in the Southern Hemisphere. So I think that's something that we might want to start thinking about during our business meeting in the next couple of days and over the next year. We've been doing a lot of work on international neuroethics sort of business matters out of UBC. The international network was the brainchild of Remy Curion and Astrid Eberhardt in Canada. And with Sophia Lombera, we've been really working to bring in the community, the international members. And what we'd like to do now is convert or move the network structure into one that really is a formal chapters or branch structure for the Neuroethics Society, so we can start seeing local and regional meetings in different countries, and also a wide representation of the international community on our executive board immediately, and also as we now look to new officers, the officers of the future, as we as old guard phase out with our duty almost done.
Managed to get back to our work.
Well, this has been work, but it's been a joy. So,
but I did take you down a digression from your substantive work. You talked about your first two of your three areas of work. What's the third one?
Oh, thank you for asking. It's a very new direction for us, and it's actually one that will be rolled out today by Daniel Buckman, who's one of the Neuroethics Society's student winners, poster winners, and it is a focus on addictions, and of course. Wayne Hall and Adrian Carter have been writing a lot about neuroethics and addiction in the past, and we are very interested in the intersection of neuroethics and supervised injection sites. And it's Vancouver is, I think, one of the only cities in the world, if not the only city, in which supervised injection sites exist. And we've started to look at them through a really biopsychosocial models of addiction.
And just to clarify for our listeners, these are injection sites for heroin users?
These are heroin users, and there are really two kinds of sites. There's one kind of site in which the drugs are actually provided to those who enter the site, and the sites that we call supervised injection sites also are available to individuals who bring in drugs that were obtained on the street, and it provides them with an opportunity to inject using clean works, clean equipment, in a safe site. And so, of course, it's very controversial. There are many pros and cons from no matter what point of view you look at it. And so there are these two models of addiction support. We're looking at these addiction sites through a biopsychosocial model. Daniel is proposing that it's really an integration of three kinds of principles from virtue, communitarian, and utilitarian ethics that will best bring us to dealing with some of the neuroethics problems that these sites present as a model, and forging ahead in trying to inform good policy on the subject.
Well, the three areas you talked about, I noticed you didn't talk about an area where some of your earliest work in neuroethics was, which I think was really important to the foundation of this field, the work on incidental findings. Because I think that work showing that if you just take a bunch of research subjects, a bunch of controls, apparently healthy college students, you find weird things in a frighteningly high percentage of their brains, and no one had thought about what to do about that before you and your groups began to push that. I thought that was so important in the foundation of this because it was a clear ethical issue that the scientists recognized as, wow, there are some real ethical issues in what we're doing here that we need to think about. So what's your sense now, 5-6 years later, about the impact of your work on incidental findings?
You know, it's funny you ask about that as a focus for my work because incidental findings is more like a limb of a third arm of my body than it is a focus of my work. We continue very vigorously on that subject, and we're doing a very interesting study now that is based in health economics, and that is where we spent the first 5 years of our work on incidental findings thinking about some ethical parameters for deciding what to do with them when a finding is discovered. We're actually now trying to assess what are the real costs, both in terms of money and in terms of psychological effects, of the four different approaches that we proposed as morally acceptable for following incidental findings, whether it's the do-nothing approach, but whereas always in the context of subjects being informed that there may be an incidental finding, and that when they sign up for a study, that might occur, and being told how investigators will, in fact, pursue a finding if it's discovered. Now we want to understand what is the cost of those paths, and we're using aneurysm as a model, and we're looking at age differences, gender differences, differences for people who have a family history of neurologic disease, and we're finding some very interesting results, which I can't tell you about yet, because we're just at the point of validating our models. So it's very, very exciting. I hope to be back next year in another interview with you, Hank, and be able to share with you the results of this really exciting next step in incidental findings.
Well, I certainly expect that there'll be another annual meeting of the Neuroethics Society next year. This meeting has been a roaring success so far, and I'm looking forward to the next day of it. Thanks so much, Judy, for being here and talking with me for these last few minutes.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Hank. And many thanks to the AAAS for hosting us here these days. It's a privilege to be here in a wonderful venue to really roll out our dream.
Right, and without the AAAS's support over the years, Alan Leshner as the head of the AAAS, and the Don Kennedy as the former editor of Science, Mark Frankel's work, and the Dana Foundation as well, from Bill Sapphire on down, this society would not exist.